RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
Hello and welcome to the RDI Insights podcast series, where I will be interviewing major figures in the design industry who have been made RSA Royal Designers for Industry, the highest accolade for a designer in the UK. The award was introduced in 1936 to highlight and honour the work of industrial designers for their sustained creative excellence and benefit to society. My guest today is the architectural designer John Pawson. For over three decades, he has been dedicated to eliminating the unnecessary in the spaces and buildings he designs. His creative path was long and winding before he finally found his passion in architecture. He first came to notice in the early 80s when he redesigned his girlfriend's flat, resulting in an intense sense of calm and absence. These minimal spaces, along with his attention to detail and materials used, became his hallmark, and his practice organically grew with a list of clients wanting his particular vision brought to their worlds, and included Calvin Klein, who arrived unannounced one day at John's practice and commissioned him to design his flagship New York store. That spawned many clients, including the international hotelier Ian Schlager, and the arrival of a group of Cistercian monks to his office with a very special project on offer. So join me now to hear John Pawson's frank, funny, and personal reflection on his life. Our conversation took place remotely with me in Dorset and John at his home in the Cotswolds. I started by asking John about the design of his country retreat, where he lives with his interior designer wife, Catherine.
Retreat is quite a good term for it, actually.
You started your practice by kind of reworking the flat you were sharing with Hester Van Rooyen back in the 80s. And I remember seeing that flat because it was publicised quite a lot at the time. And I think the essence of that early thinking has kind of unfolded throughout all of your work. So I would think Home Farm must be really for you the kind of summation of your thinking, because it's your home and obviously Catherine, who is your wife, and she is an interior designer as well. So could you, you know, paint a picture of what you had to do and where it is and so forth?
Well, I think when you say summation of everything, I mean, I think every project we do, or every project I do, I tend to think of it as my own, even though it's obviously, you know, a client's, you know, own thoughts and feelings that go into it. But I sort of treat everything very quite personally. I mean, the only difference with this project, doing our own home, was that I could take more risks, I suppose, than I would, you know, with the clients.
And you have no client meetings, of course. Maybe apart from the parish council, perhaps.
Well, you know, a lot of the planners here. But of course, even if it's for yourself, you know, obviously what Catherine thinks is really important, and she's a fantastic contributor. And I ask my children and they come up with all sorts of things like saunas in the pond and quad bikes, all the wrong things.
I noticed that in another photograph you had designed a chair called Tacta, is that correct?
Yes.
And
yes.
I saw that you replaced the Hans Wegner wishbone chairs. Was that just for a photograph, or do you now have those chairs as your permanent fixture?
Well, they very kindly gave me the eight chairs, which was very generous, and I suppose I'm trying them out. It's the litmus test.
I think they look actually very beautiful, I have to say, and I know you mentioned in an earlier interview that at some point everybody has to design a chair, and I've often thought, why? Because there are so many beautiful chairs. But I think you've cracked it with that one, because it is extremely attractive. I hope it works as well for you as the Hans Wegner ones.
The jury's slightly out. It's a hell of a chair to put it up against. But the chair that we've done does work, which is was quite a relief. I mean, it's the hardest thing of all, isn't it? I mean, I've fought shy of doing a chair. I mean, I've tried on paper and I've tried the odd prototype in the last 40 years. And this is the first time we've actually done something, you know, that has been manufactured and made and sold and sort of tested.
Let's leave the John Pawson as you are now with, 433,000 Instagram followers? I think almost 300 projects under your belt and 24 book, many awards, Royal Designer, CBE. So let's park that and go back to when you were born, which is 6th of May 1949 in Halifax, Yorkshire, into what I understand a fairly wealthy family. Your father, James, and mother, Winifred, were both from, I think, a dynasty of textile industry manufacturers, which your father continued to run. Anyway, you were the youngest of five children. You have four sisters, Jane, Rachel, Janet, and Diana. And you lived in Smith House in Lightfield, kind of a rambling 17th century stone-built property. What was life like with four older sisters? Were you kind of their pet sort of thing?
Yeah, they're actually, my thing is that I was bullied mercilessly, but of course that their recollection is that I was spoiled terribly. But it was jolly nice. It was quite a feminine sort of, you know, warm and sort of friendly and you know, they were jolly nice. They're actually my half-sisters. I didn't find out. My mother didn't tell me till I was, I think, in my early teens that actually her husband had been killed in the war and my father's wife had died of meningitis. So
oh dear.
They both had two daughters each and they got together and then had me.
So they've got a kind of mix and match family.
Yeah, but the deal with my parents had was that everyone would be treated equally, and so they were just sisters. They weren't half sisters or stepsisters or, you know.
At a fairly young age, you were sent off to board at I think it's called Malsip Prep Malsip, School.
Yeah.
Malsip.
Yeah.
How was that? How old were you when you actually went off?
Seven, because I was sort of, because I was born in May, I think it somehow, you know, I was, you know, one of the youngest in the class.
Oh, right.
Because I don't know how it worked, but I always seemed to be sort of a year younger than the others.
How was that experience for you? I've spoken to others in interviews and it seems to vary enormously. And so I'm interested to know how you coped suddenly being away from your home and your sisters.
Well, it was very odd. It was very odd. I mean, certainly the first night was very weird. But you just, you know, you just sort of got on with it, I guess. I mean, I think it was harder for other people. I mean, I didn't find it so bad. And it's like later on, you know, with bullying, you know, it's a terrible thing that happens, and you always feel that you should have stood out more against it. When it happened to you, I mean, I tended to sort of think that it was, I mean, flattering's not quite the right word, but I mean, you know, I just saw it as getting a bit of attention, actually.
Obviously, you had to, you came home for various breaks, whether that, you know, the weekends or certainly holidays, and it sounded to me, reading about you, as if you had rather wonderful family holidays with your father occasionally chartering a plane down to Cornwall, which sounds amazing.
Well, I mean, Dad was a bit flash too. I mean, I think that part of me is my father, obviously, and I mean, my mother was genuinely a very modest person, even though she came from, you know, actually a more materially wealthy background than my father.
Right.
He liked those sort of good things.
Well, then, of course, a little later on, when you were 13, you were shipped off to Eton.
Yes, I mean, Dad went to Rossall, which was a boarding school in Lancashire, near Fleetwood on the sea. But he thought Eton might be even better. He just was interested in what was on superlatives.
I think he put your name down when you were very young, didn't he?
Well, that was what you had to do if you wanted to try and get a place. So he travelled down with Mum and to be interviewed by a master who was collecting a list for to be a future house master. And when the guy opened the door, my father, of course, thought it was the house master's son, because he was so young. But,
this was your main education, really, I guess. So what was it like? I mean, give us a...
It was my main education because I didn't do terribly well with. I had a problem with exams, so I never really. I got some O levels, but I did.
So you were not very academic, really. Is that what you're saying? It was not your.
I don't know what it was. I mean, I'm not dyslexic, and I don't really have learning difficulties. I mean, I don't know whether it was. It was not something that, you know, that I enjoyed, or, you know, the subjects weren't the subjects I was interested in, I suppose. I don't know.
I think it was there that you were bullied, you said. I think that's where the bullying came in. And I think, did they not also still have corporal punishment there, caning, that sort of thing?
Yes. Again, you know, I just thought that was... I mean, you have bullying throughout. Life, I think. I mean, and you have to try and stand up, and you have to stand up for other people. But I guess it was more recognisable at that age, and corporal punishment was still thought of as being, you know, a way to deal with, you know, discipline, I suppose. I mean, I just thought. Again, I quite liked the attention, but I mean, it must have been, you know, for some boys, I could see it was, you know, very damaging.
As you sort of hinted earlier, your grades were not good at Eton. You obviously couldn't go off to university because you didn't have, you know, what was necessary, but you decided to go off on a bit of a global trek.
Yeah, well, it was 66. It was the start of the sort of hippie movement.
But you're only 17, weren't you?
Yes, but my contemporaries were 18. If you see, I was interesting that my parents, who were always very concerned for me or about me, didn't seem to think it was quite normal for me to hitchhike to to India and beyond. It was just a sort of curious. I mean, it was that hippie trail. Afghanistan and all those places.
But you went on, didn't you, to go further?
Well, I spent six months in India and then ended up in Sydney in Australia. And eventually got a telegram from my father saying if I didn't come back, there wouldn't be a place for me in the family business.
You did have to come back.
I did have to come back.
But wasn't it via the States? Didn't you? Weren't you there briefly?
I wanted to see... My sister was in Virginia with her husband because they were in a hospital there. He was a doctor. And then I went to New York to look up Liza Minnelli, who I'd spent time with in Sydney, where I'd met her through my Australian girlfriend, who was her sister-in-law, her husband at the time's sister. So we sort of hung out a bit there. I mean, I was 17, but she was only 21. So I had quite a fun time in New York. But then I came back to Yorkshire and went straight up to my father's factory in Washington County, Durham.
I think that you were there in all for another 6 years at the factory.
I was, yeah.
And you did various things. I've seen a photograph of you holding up a sketch of a dress because I think some clothing was made. And I think the idea was that you were, I don't know whether it was you or whether the idea was to bring out sort of more trendy clothes that were more in connection with what was going on at that time. I mean, 6 years is a long time, so you must have really got into that world.
I tried my best. I mean, you know, I was very, very fond of my father, and he was very charismatic. I spent time up in the factory near Newcastle, and then more time in Halifax, which was the headquarters, and then eventually we had a showroom in London. So I eventually got down there. So I mean, 6 years is a long time, but I guess it just went by. But it took a long time to realise that it wasn't for me. I suppose I could have, you know, it could have been foreseen.
Did you enjoy any of it, really?
I must have, but I mean, a lot of boredom. and a lot of kind of outside London, you know, in a sense, and London's so different. I don't regret having, you know, lived in these places. It's just, and boredom has a strange way of making you dream.
Yeah, you started to, I think, meet more interesting people for you. Anyway, I think some from Japan. And I think there was in your book that Morris and Mary Pinder, who taught at Newcastle School of Art or College of Art, became friends. And so perhaps your creative, you know, mind was beginning to, you know, the antennae started to go up and you were making some early sort of connections.
I think so. They introduced me, or the director introduced me to Domus magazine. And that was a revelation in a way. And that's where I first saw Kurumata's work.
Yeah, the Japanese design, which we'll talk about a little later. Yeah. I think it was, you'd seen a documentary, which I think you said, about Buddhist monks, which sort of rather intrigued you. And I think you decided that that's for you, to be a Buddhist monk.
I was 24 going on about 12, I think. Yeah. I mean, I was like, how I possibly thought I could, you know, as a Zen, reach a sort of state of enlightenment as a Zen Buddhist monk.
But do tell the story, because I think it's a great story. Tell me.
No, well, I'd seen this film, and I can't find this documentary at all, but I think it was either Tony Richardson or Tony.
I tried to find it too. I couldn't.
Maybe not either of those two.
There is a Tony Richardson who is an expert in this area, so I think he had the same name as the British director. But anyway, tell us.
No, well, I think the monastery was Aheiji in the north of Japan, and it's very beautiful. And the Zen Buddhist monks practice kendo as a just physical training. You know, it was winter, and the film was really beautiful. And I thought, oh, everything was going wrong. You know, I mean, Dad had said, you know, maybe this isn't working, and there isn't really. You know, I'm going to close down the company you were running. It looked as if, I mean, my plans to get married to my fiance, that wasn't working either. So having lost both those things, I headed off to Japan to try and enter this monastery, which I did. But of course, the reality hit me in the middle of the night, and I suddenly woke up and realized, what an idiot, you know, how could I possibly, you know, survive? Or,
well, could you describe what the routine was? Because I think that's the thing.
Well, I mean, you arrive and they say, you know, they don't even say hello. They just sort of, you're let in. I mean, it had been arranged for me through a friend and who had a connection. And so they just took you and you just get assigned to start scrubbing the, you know, the corridor, the floors and the stairs of the corridor. And you get a sort of bowl of hot, it seemed like hot water, and there's a room full of other guys. If eventually you can sleep, but it wasn't so much the physical hardship as you know. I mean, I suppose that's what daydream or dreaming is you're so detached from reality that you think, you know, I travelled all the way to Japan and all the way to this monastery, only to realise within minutes that I completely made the wrong decision. Luckily, not too many people knew that's what I was up to.
You then stayed on, and you, I think you started to teach English, didn't you, at Nagoya? Yes. Nagoya?
Yeah, in Nagoya. That was my other contact. One was a Japanese friend whose father was a Buddhist monk, and the other was a woman whose father-in-law was taught at this university, and they were looking for an Englishman to teach English.
But you didn't speak Japanese? How do you do that?
I spoke English.
Yes. But I mean, if they didn't understand English, I don't know how it would work.
Well, the students didn't, no.
No.
But I think that they had Japanese teachers who could... Well, no, who did teach English. But they wanted sort of an example of, I suppose, inverted commas, the real thing or something. They wanted somebody who spoke English. And there was some confusion because they thought Eton was a university. And they printed me a card with Eton BA ons after it. And And I thought it would be manners to piss out to them. But anywhere else that I helped hire, all had to have first-class degrees from Oxford. And then at a pinch, Cambridge. I mean, they were very, you know, they did like, you know, titles or whatever.
You often would go off on little trips to other parts, and you would stay in traditional Ryokan inns. Can you describe those for listeners?
Well, what was wonderful about the job was you got a lot of time off, and also I had some very, very nice students who helped me get around. So we used to do these long weekends in very remote places in Japan, where to begin with I went in to the very modest inn and tried to ask if there was a room. But of course, as soon as they saw you coming, you know, the reception was empty. Because they were too scared. Well, first of all, they didn't speak English, and then to see a foreigner turn up in the middle of nowhere, they thought must be something wrong. And then I try and send my students in, and they say, well, we haven't booked. And I said, well, they might have a room. And they said, no, we haven't booked. And I said, well, why don't you go and ask them? No, we can't do that. That's not...
That's not Japanese. So
that's, you know, that wouldn't be polite. Anyway, I finally shouted at them. So we got a system going where we managed to find these exquisite places, which were so modest and of course, it was a nice thing that they'd never had foreigners there before, you know. So you did feel somehow that it was authentic. It was sort of part of. It was like sort of going back a couple of hundred years.
Do you feel that in any way those simple interior spaces, particularly, you know, where you sleep with a futon, little else, I mean, basically screens, that it was. It sort of made a connection with you, that it had a more profound effect on you, that simplicity of those inns?
Well, I think, obviously absorbing the way Japanese people live and have lived,
yes,
you know, over the several centuries, you know, and the bathing and the and that setting out the bed in the middle of the room and the feeling of space and having your head sort of free. I mean, that they were all wonderful things. And when I got back from Japan after, I think, nearly 5 years away, I managed to keep going in London for 3 years, sort of with futon and sleeping in the middle of the room. And then eventually it became, you know, it suits Japan, and they make it happen. Difficult to translate it over here.
I have a Japanese daughter-in-law, so I've been a few times and absolutely was astonished by just the grace and charm of the people. It does make you think differently, that's for sure. While you were there, of course, you also freelanced as a photographer.
Because I find sketching difficult, even before I got into architecture, I would always take photographs to remind myself and to sort of explain to other people. Stuff and I use them with the students. I was always sort of photographing. And socially, I met a guy that had an agency of photographers and, you know, and a library and an agency, because he sold the photographs. And he sent me back to Europe to photograph sporting events. And I mean, they're very, very generous. They tend to give you the money before you do it and the expenses. And of course, I came back with all these photographs of you know, the Grand Prix race. But of course, I was more interested in the detail of the wing of the car, sunlight on the chrome or something. And he wondered why I hadn't taken a picture of the finish.
I think you moved on to Tokyo, didn't you, in your final sort of period there?
It took me ages, but I finally got.
You had a reason for being there, because you wanted to, by this time I think you'd seen the work of Shiro Kurumata, the Japanese designer and architect, and you wanted to meet him.
Well, you know, typical naive sort of, or, you know, arrogant Englishman, I just rang him up and said, you know, any chance of meeting up? And I guess he thought I must be somebody that he couldn't say no to. So he was curious, or one of those two things. So we ended up having coffee, and he brought Masayuki Kurokawa, Kisho's brother, who spoke English, or spoke, was quite fluent in English. He brought him with him, and Kurokawa, Masayuki, was also very sort of sophisticated, so he was able to suss what was going on a bit more. But he was very charming about it all. It all went rather well, and then I sort of kept in touch with Kuramata during the year in Tokyo, and he was so generous. He invited me to all the sort of openings of things that he'd designed or other people had designed, and if you sort of got that introduction at that level, everybody else that you met was as good in their field as he was in his. So you met Isazaki or, you know, and designers, and so it was a great time. But of course, not working, eventually you can't sort of spend a year not really working, although I managed it nearly a year.
I think Shiro basically said you've got to go to an architectural school. You've got to do something.
You've got to do it yourself. Yeah. Yeah. Stop hanging around me and go and...
So you went back to the UK, and I think, what, you were age 29, 1978? You joined the architectural, London Architectural Association in Bedford Square. And I think you were probably one of the oldest students there, weren't you?
Without doubt, yeah. 30 doesn't seem very old now, but...
No,
it was then, when a lot of the students weren't even 20.
So they were all doing their thing, i.e. not working or coming in late or, you know, having a good time.
Learning about life.
Exactly.
Yeah. I just wanted to learn about architecture, but I sort of tried to learn to fit in.
Did you get anything out of it? I mean, did you?
Definitely.
You did,
definitely.
Yeah,
I mean, the biggest thing I learned was... was that you can learn how to design. Just thought it's something you have or not. And but I was taught how to design, which I was obviously very fortunate.
Well, this is where we kind of move into your practice, if you like, because you met and moved in with Hester Van Rooyen, who was your girlfriend at the time, and she was an art dealer. Still is an art dealer, I think, went to work for Leslie Waddington and later had her own gallery. And the flat that she lived in and you moved in with her, you decided that needed your attention, put it that way. So what did you do?
Yes, I mean, it's probably unforgivable, but I always had this thing where I felt incredibly strongly about my own sort of personal environment, which even if it was only rented, it seemed very, very important for me, almost essential to try and get it the way I liked it, which now, of course, if it would have been perhaps as well not, you know, to hold back a little bit, you know, because we were renting it, and some time before it had been partitioned, it was clearly a glorious room hidden behind a partition. So I just knocked the wall down one day and carried out the rubbish, you know, in sacks in the middle of the night and put them in other people's skips, which I've, of course, since learned is incredibly irritating if you rent a skip and somebody else puts their stuff in it.
Expensive these days.
Yeah, very expensive. Well, even then, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. So did you carry all that work out yourself or did you have help?
Some of the stuff I did myself, but I one of Hester's artists actually was also did house painting and carpentry and things like that.
Yeah.
Plumbing. So together he and I and another person managed to put it together.
And that was seen by Bruce Chatwin, who I know became a good friend of yours, and he loved it so much that he asked you to do his flat.
Yes, yeah, no, he came around one day and he was completely transfixed by it. He just sort of, I mean, it was a small space, but he just walked around it and was physically moved by it. And you know, and then we did his flat.
And I think you were impressed by him, not just because of his work, but his ability to, I think you've said, to articulate what your work represented in a really terrific way.
Well, I've always thought that photographs aren't very satisfactory way. Photography is not a very satisfactory way to describe architecture. Of course, it's much better than nothing.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to convey the atmosphere people always say when they come here, you know, that our place in the country, that, you know, it's completely different from the photographs, which of course is exaggerated because, of course, it's not completely different, but there's a lot missing. I think you know, the three-dimensional quality to it and everything else. But Bruce could describe architecture incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wished he was obviously still around. I mean, obviously because I miss him, but also because he wrote so well about architecture.
You left the A before taking your final exam for the reasons
becoming a pattern.
Yeah. And you've never been badged as an architect. I mean, a lot of people refer to you as an architect or an architectural designer, but the keepers of that title can be a bit sticky, can't they? I think Thomas Heatherwick has the same issue. He's not an architect either.
Well, there's a long list which I haven't put together, and I'm not that sort of, it's not my thing, but people like Ando
who's terrific.
I mean, there are quite a few other people who haven't technically qualified. I mean, the ARB has a job to do, quite rightly, to uphold and protect, you know, the name. And I think it's quite right that they should. And it's just personally, I never call myself an architect. But it is very difficult when you're trying to describe what you do and you go in a long-winded way.
Yeah.
And then the people say, oh, well, you mean architect?
Yes.
And I say, well, yes, but I, you know, and then you start again and it's sort of... But I'm not sure if it's one person, but there's somebody who every time they see, you know, that a newspaper or something's got it wrong, you know, and call me an architect, that they write into the ARB.
Nevertheless,
I feel sorry for him or her.
Yes, they must. But nevertheless, you went on to establish your own practice, aged 32, I think, when all the other students leaving would be trying to just work with an architectural firm, as they all do. So that was quite a thing. Where were you based with that? With your very first sort of space to work in?
I did, well, obviously that I started on the kitchen table in Hester's flat that we converted, you know, that we just talked about. And then Hester moved to another flat, which I did. And during the day we had the drawing tables out, and then at night had to clear them away. So it was quite stressful. And she was very generous to let us, you know, work in her, which was... I mean, technically her flat. Well, it was her flat.
How many of you were at that point?
Well, there was Claudia Silvestrin and I.
Oh, yes.
And then Vishwa Kushal, who'd just come down or just come up from Bath School of Architecture and just qualified. And that was like in 1985 or 1984, I think.
And there was a period, you just mentioned Claudio Silvestrin. You actually, for a brief period, were more connected, weren't you? I think you had you shared the name.
Yes, I remember Claudio saying, you know, I want to be a partner. And I suppose the supposition was that, I'll make my own way somewhere else. So I said, oh, yeah, you know, no problem at all, you know. And if that's what you want to be, fine. And I had no idea of the strength of just saying, you know, that you're a partner means you are a partner and you're, you know, you have a 50% share, unless you set it out differently.
Mm.
It's a very, and it doesn't need anything writing down particularly. I mean, Claudia's, you know, introduced me to so much.
Mm.
So, you know, that short period that we were together was fantastic for that.
It was the Neuendorf House in Mallorca in Spain that really, you know, became a very important project for you. It was, I remember being featured a lot in magazines at the time. And you then parted company, didn't you, after that?
Claudia had a very good point, because I was splitting up from Hester, and I didn't have any money, and you know it was just very stressful, and I wasn't concentrating on work at all, and I in fact you know, the reverse. I was sort of really prejudicing his chances of, you know, because obviously all we wanted to do was to build.
Yes.
And you know, and I was sort of almost sabotaging it.
Of course, that whole period in the early days was when postmodernism was kind of at its sort of height, which is a complete opposite to your world. I mean, postmodernism is all about sticking things on, you know, overly decorating buildings and making them a bit Egyptian, bit this, bit that. And a lot of architects also at that time in the 80s didn't have very much work. It was a sort of tricky time, I think, I seem to remember. Certainly in about 86, because I was able to get pretty notable architects to work on a project when we moved studios and bought a warehouse. And David Chipperfield was available, and we used David.
Right.
So I know that then it was a very thin period, but I think you seem to quietly carry on.
Yes, I mean, we didn't talk about it, but I mean, I never sort of, I didn't have a game plan. I didn't think, well, I never thought that I would end up in practice. I thought, you know, that I was just interested in architecture. I didn't necessarily think, you know, I started doing the odd thing, but I remember I was I had this aversion to files or filing anything.
Very difficult.
So until it was pointed out to me that there's a legal requirement to keep things for whatever many years it is.
So who's managed to really sort of build that structure around you then? I mean, because of course dealing with architecture involves masses of files, and maybe it's a lot more digital these days, but I mean, certainly drawings and all those sort of things take up so much of those box files and other files.
Oh God, and plan chests.
Yes, exactly.
I eventually got all those things, and I had, and also I hired, got people to come and work with me who were, you know, RIBA, and understood these things didn't have an aversion. I remember, buying all these lights files. Lights made all the files, you know, during pre-war for the Nazis. So they were sort of had an unfortunate connotation, but they were very efficient.
Through the 90s, you started to design a wider mix of projects. I mean, you were doing gallery spaces, exhibition spaces, apartments for some notable people. I think Michael Craig Martin, you did his place,
yes,
didn't you?
The bridge that we designed at Kew.
Oh, yes. Very nice. The Sackler Bridge, yeah. Or it's changed its name, I think, but yeah. Which is very beautiful. It's a lovely thing. Let's just move on a bit now, because you're well into the 90s. You've had quite a lot of more important projects, and then suddenly you get a call from Calvin Klein, which is kind of a bit not the normal thing to happen, but he calls you and asks you to do some work for him.
Looking back, I mean, that changed my life, not just my career. It changed everything. It was an extraordinary moment, really, looking back. But he was looking for a young designer that would help him, because he was always interested in architecture and probably would have been an architect or could have been an architect. So he was looking for somebody who could really translate his ideas into a store. And he'd been given some books, one of which was mine, by Ian Schrager. And so if he looked me up when he was in London. But I had a basement office, because obviously it was a very modest rent, and the office said, oh, we've got Calvin Klein on the phone. And I said, oh, you know, don't be ridiculous, go back to work, because you know, they were always playing practical jokes on me, you know, going out and ringing up and pretending to be, you know, Saudi Arabia or whatever, and wanting a huge project. And they said, no, he's on the phone. And I said, you know, I said again, don't be ridiculous. And, you know, I picked it up, and then this voice said, hi. It's Calvin. It's like, oh my God. And then I said, oh, do come and see me sometime. And he said, well, I'm outside in the car. So, anyway, it was quite funny.
You went on to do his HQ in New York, which is, it's funny because looking at your work and looking at professional career, it seems to me that several things became very clear. Your work is a perfect vehicle for other things. So in your early days, galleries and artists' work within your spaces work very well. And then you move on to the world of fashion. And again, your spaces are perfect for a very minimal look at, you know, beautiful clothes. I mean, it's not, they're never the crowded shops with everything packed in. They're just hung like pieces of art, I suppose.
Well, it was interesting because Calvin would take out more and more. He'd hired Gabriella Forte away from Armani, and which made him hopping mad. And she arrived and knew how to deal with retail. I mean, she was an expert, obviously. But Calvin went in after her and took out a lot of stuff. See, he wanted, you know, much more stark than either I or Gabriella was intending for the store. It was very much helping him to have the store that he wanted. And interestingly, you know, because I was used to, before that, I was used to, because they were small projects, I was used to be able to, you know, have what I would say pretty good control over everything.
Mm.
I'm not saying that my decisions were necessarily the best, but at least they were mine.
Mm.
When you move on to a bigger scale, like the size of his door, there was a lot of give and take, which I wasn't used to. And a lot of the details were actually Calvin's. You know, he liked a lot of contrast, you know, a lot of black and white. And it was a huge learning curve for me, huge. And working on that scale and in that, you know, with that exposure and everything else that rode on it.
Well, we'll move on to another project with scale, I think, which I think is another major piece of work that you did, and that's the Abbey of Our Lady in Novi Dvor. I think about your early life and going off to live with the monks in Japan, and then all those years later, you get contacted by a bunch of monks to come and see you because they wanted to talk to you about a project.
Yeah, well, and of course you think, you know, somebody's having a joke again, you know, because you know, and that's people's reaction when I tell them about it, because they say, oh, they didn't realize that, you know, Trappist Cistercian monks are still building new monasteries, you know, around the world.
Well, having the money to build them too, that's extraordinary.
Well, they're experts at raising, and what they do, which I didn't realize, was they just ask for small donation, but they ask you to suggest 20 more people who might contribute.
Kind of like a pyramid operation,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's a lot of people with small amounts.
Yeah.
And then they also they don't say if we're building a whole monastery. They say we're going to start on one wing of a monastery. And so then, of course, when they built that, they then come back to you, and you're slightly I wouldn't say stuck, but but people have been very generous and contribute and carry on doing it. I mean, occasionally you get somebody who contributes a huge amount.
How did you feel? Because, you know, a place of worship seems to me the perfect vehicle for your work. Minimal distractions. I mean, I know a lot of churches are completely over the top with stained glass windows and everything, but generally speaking, when you think of monks, it is a very stripped back existence. Long tables where they have their breakfast in silence and so forth. It does seem to fit perfectly into your view of things. How did you feel getting that project?
I mean, I realized immediately it's a project of a lifetime. I mean, it's what you know, kind of a dream commission. I mean, to get you to do a whole monastic city, you know, is they never leave it. They live there their whole lives and the whole time. The gardens or the land is extensive, but they don't leave those compounds normally.
And it's a silent order, is it?
Yeah, they're Trappist. Yes.
Wow.
And then, I mean, well, actually, it makes it much easier because if you don't talk, you can't argue. It's only a practical thing the silence. It just makes life easier. I mean, if you need to talk for practical reasons, they have parloirs in off the cloister. They have a little boxes you can go into, like telephone booth.
Oh, I see.
And
right.
You can have a natter. And obviously, when I was working with them, if they were outside the cloister or the church and things like that, then you could have a meeting. Yeah, and they had readings, and, you know, and they were addressed by the abbot and things like that. So it's not, but it's a wonderful, that silence. I mean, they let me stay for a week, and I actually slept in the dormitory with them, which is, I've never heard of that happening before. So it was like, you know, the routine was the same as they have that I experienced for a week. You know, the eight offices of the day, you know, starting at three in the morning.
Wow, that's early.
They wanted somebody who they thought got it, you know, that understood what they wanted. And they didn't need me to be, I mean, I think they presumed I was Christian, but I could have been Jewish or, you know, as long as I could do the job, I think it was probably the most important thing. I mean, I remember going up for communion and the prior saying to me, you know, just wagging his finger, because I wasn't Catholic, I couldn't accept the
communion. But presumably they must have seen something in order to contact you that resonated. Yeah,
they saw the Calvin Klein store.
Oh, they did, so...
Yeah, well, of course.
Well, that seems most odd, doesn't it, for a bunch of...
Well, of course, that's why English is so imprecise, because, of course, they'd seen the Calvin Klein store in a book. So they'd seen a space with the two tables, which they saw that could easily be altars.
And, yes, exactly.
So they thought there was somebody who could do the job. Because you design a church and you do the proportions and you materials and light and everything else. And then you hope that, you know, when it's consecrated and the monks are using it, that it has a spiritual feel.
Yes.
And that they can get closer to God and all the rest of it. But there's no guarantees. I mean, it's still bricks and mortar, and there's no sort of magic. And I think it's very confusing because people, you know, feel that some of the secular work that I do has a spiritual feel, but it doesn't. I mean, it's, you know, the church is spiritual, the rest isn't, if that makes sense.
Well, I think you also made that on another project, that little wooden structure, which has a cross, I think, cut into the end of it so that the light penetrates it at certain times.
Yes.
And it's very simple, but I thought that was incredibly spiritual. I was brought up a Catholic. The last place I want to go is to church.
Such a pity that, because of course I wasn't, and I love being in churches.
No, I love to go to churches, but I don't like to go to church with the congregation. Yeah. And because being brought up a Catholic, it's drummed into you more than anything else. I wanted to move on to really your brand, and I don't really like the term brand. I'd prefer identity, but brand means something far greater. It's the totality of how something is expressed. And I think more than any other architectural designer, you have such a clear identity. When I look at your work and buildings, the interiors, the book, the graphics, your website, food recipes, social media, it's very consistent and considered. And I just want, it obviously needs rigorous discipline to adhere to. So would you agree with that? Would you agree? Do you take that personal care over all those things? Because a lot of firms don't.
No, I mean, I guess it's become second nature over the years. I think it was always there. And of course, you know, witnessing Calvin and his company, obviously on a huge scale, different scale altogether, his attention to detail, he would think nothing of taking a whole day with me to discuss a window detail, which is more than I needed. But, you know, he thought that was necessary. And then, you know, by at 8 o'clock in the evening, he would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've got to go to, you know, to a design meeting for his clothes," which seemed more important to me. But anyway, you know, the details are very, very important.
Yes.
But it's interesting that I don't, I mean, I am, you know, I like things, you know, done well, whatever we're doing. But I'm not necessarily, I don't have that fastidiousness safe. You know, I don't worry about my clothes or, you know, I don't fuss over things. You know, they don't, I like things to be right.
It's obviously a lot simpler if you hit on a set of clothes that actually you're happy with and they just become you. Why change? If it's a great shirt and a great sweater and shoes, and that's it. I think, you know, I was writing about some various designers recently, and some of them are so, particularly Americans, so outrageous. you know, pink suit with huge sunglasses. You know, I just think, what is going on? You know, it's more about them than the work, really. But anyway, that's just a typical kind of grumpy Englishman's idea. We've mentioned the Sackler Crossing, or in fact you did, which is a lovely sweeping thing, and I walked across it. It's very beautiful. You've done lots of hotels for Ian Schrager, who we've also mentioned. You've done ballet sets as well, which was another change for you, wasn't it? And they were very beautiful. I think one was...
For Wayne McGregor.
Yes, that's right. The Royal Opera House, Royal Ballet, yeah. You've done a Second World War telecommunications bunker in Berlin. What was that? What was that for?
That was for Desiree Fuerle, who's a German art dealer, and he saw an opportunity.
Slightly ironic, putting it in a bunker, and he's a German art collector. Isn't that exactly what they did?
I never see that quite. But it's funny, like, because I was doing the Catholic Church of the diocese in St. Moritz Church.
Oh yes, yes.
In Augsburg.
Yeah.
In Germany.
And, which is another one that you consider to be one of your very best pieces.
Yes, it's well, it worked out well. I mean, it's an existing building that we renovated, but I bumped into four nuns there, and they said, "Why on earth did they get an Englishman to design a church that the English had bombed?" Yeah, we bombed it.
That's a rather nice touch, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, they were much happier when they finally got to see the finished. They approved, luckily.
You hooked up with Diane Sujuk, who I know you've known for a long time, and in fact has written your latest book or collaborated on it. But I think he's been there in the background a long time, and you were commissioned to, in competition, I think, because I had to do that. You reworked the design museum, its permanent home. And that's an extraordinary building to start with anyway, because you've got this massive sort of atrium area to sort of deal with, and the roof structure, which is, I think it's all listed, isn't it?
It was all listed. Yeah. And it was interesting because Dan said that they were going to take over this building for the design museum, and they were going to have a competition. And I don't normally do competition. And he said, "Well, you should." And I said, "Well, I don't do competitions." And you know, he's a friend, and he's also very diffident, and he has a very, very nice manner of persuading people. But I suddenly realised that it didn't seem as if I was going to have an option. I mean, the competition was huge. I mean, there were 100 people, and it was everyone. You know, and a lot of people could have done a really beautiful job. I just felt, because it was him, that, you know, that we had to put a lot more into the competition than you would normally even do. I mean, I think there's a sort of, you know, in paid competitions, there's some sort of rule where you tend to spend three times what you're given to try and have a chance of winning it.
Yes, I've heard that.
I was determined to spend five times as much.
Oh, really? Wow.
Well, I just thought I owed it to him to really have a go. And I remember going with Catherine. She very kindly drove me with the model to the interview once we got down to a shortlist. So I carried my model in, and then she asked me how it went afterwards. And she'd bought some sandwiches, and we were having this sandwiches in the car. And in the rearview mirror, I saw a van arrive with this gigantic model. As a joke, I said, "Oh, that'll be David's." And it was David Chipperfield, and it was four times as big as our model. So I thought I'd had it then. It was shortlisted down to the two of us.
Really?
Yeah, and it was either would have, well, obviously, it was very, very nice too. Mm. So it could have been either of us. It felt that I was nearer. I could walk every day to it.
Yeah. Interestingly, I've been to it a few times, and there's that level where there's a sheer run of, I think, Carrara marble, which I think was recycled, isn't that right? Did you?
Yeah, that was used in the Commonwealth Institute, but it was also had come before that from the Imperial Institute or whatever.
Yes.
When it was, you know, celebrating the Empire.
It's the longest bench I've ever seen, actually. But it looks
popular. It's popular.
I know. I took a photograph my girlfriend at the time. No one else was sitting. She sat on it, and the image that I took was fairly wide angle to get it all in. But it's amazing. It just goes on into the distance, you know. The other thing that I think has been important to you is actually books, because getting noticed, one can do it through articles in magazines and so forth, but you've been, I think, more than most, actually, responsible for quite a large number of books. Most of them were with Fiden, and I guess they must do pretty well, because you've been with Fiden now for a long time, and I would suspect that if they didn't do well, they wouldn't be coming back.
No, they certainly wouldn't. No. I only do the books if I have an idea. I never thought of them as being a sort of promotional thing. Fiden have a thing where they... You are under contract, in the sense that you, part of your contract is, you, I think, is that you have to offer them.
Oh, really? Wow.
The next book, you can't just go off and go with another publisher without discussion. You know, I'm very happy, you know, with them anyway. But
and the production values seem to be very good.
Yeah, well, they do allow me a little bit of leeway now. At the beginning, it was a learning curve. But it's funny because I remember somebody coming up to me and saying, "Oh, you're the one that does the books." And before that, it was, you're the one that does the shop, you know, you get branded.
Before doing this interview, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and they said, he does very well with books. And I said, oh, really? So obviously it's a well-known fact. Now tell me a little bit about also your 430,000 Instagram followers. But you take all the photographs, or more or less, don't you?
And a lot of them, take all of them.
Yeah. You do. So that's quite a commitment, and you're posting virtually every day?
I try. I don't let it become a pressure. It's just if I have a photograph for the day, sometimes I go for 10 days without, not a lot.
I've seen a lot from your home there, where, you know, you've got the different light changes, which is very good for what you were talking about earlier about, you know, a building's a building, but you've got to be in the building to experience it. Well, you've done that through a lot of those photographs, because you've made views from the window and the different times of the day, you know, do that job very well. So I think it's well worth it. I don't know of any other so much, but it's obviously paid off. You're very well known everywhere.
Yes, but it's very much a hobby. Or it was very much a hobby, and it's also a way of relaxing. And I've always taken photographs.
Well, of course, you had the exhibition, didn't you, at the Store X in London?
Yes.
I went to, which is from your book Spectrum. That was another Fiden book, wasn't it? Which was actually the first time, really, you could say there's a lot of colour.
Well, there is. I've never said there isn't.
I mean, of course there is.
Of course, the way colour gets into the room anyway,
of course,
is all white.
And then you've got all the textures of the wood and surfaces and how light reacts. I completely get that. And now you've got this new book, Making Life Simple. But what it led me to think about is really areas of work, because you've worked for many wealthy clients where money is plentiful, so that you can do those, you know, wide plank oak floors, no problem, and all the other things. So have you ever been asked to do anything sort of more humble? By that I mean, I don't mean exactly social housing, but if someone came to you and said, look, we want, the state of domestic properties in this country are either red brick Barrett homes or fake Jordan styles, like the one that King Charles has in Poundbury in Dorset, which is 10 miles from me, and it's like going to Disneyland. Would you be interested? Is that something?
Definitely. Some of the houses that we do are very, very modestly budgeted, and for people who don't have a lot, not many, but I would like to do more. And we were working on some social housing in America. I mean, it was an idea. It wasn't really very well thought out or developed, but it could have been.
Right.
It could have ended up providing a lot of social housing. So it's there in the back of my mind.
Right.
And you know, I've tended to follow the river.
Yeah.
It's, wherever it's led, it's sort of. And I know you can make things happen. I haven't. I mean, I've just sat a bit, but that definitely social housing would be high on the list.
What about the opposite extreme, which is what I would call statement buildings? You know, the whole of the London skyline now is festooned with what you would call statement buildings. And obviously they're vast things that go on for years. Is that something that you would ever consider doing?
Well, skyscraper was on the list, and we designed a couple that never got built. But there is a place, I suppose, for them both. I think I'm signature buildings. I'm not, as you were talking about, are something that attracts me particularly, as you can imagine. I mean,
yeah. What are you currently about to work on, or in the not too distant future, that you're excited about?
Well, I'm always excited. I mean, I am incredibly spoiled, so it's always a pleasure. What we do. I mean, I think it's very much more of this, what we've really talked about. I mean, it's, you know, there are some hotels, a couple of hotels, and, you know, there are, you know, we're doing a couple of, I don't know how you put it, like wine estates.
Oh, yes.
And that sort of thing.
Oh, I've seen the lovely vineyard that you've done. It's at the very end of your book. It's a terraced structure.
Oh, yeah,
which is very
beautiful.
Very lovely.
That is a private house with a backdrop of a vineyard.
Oh, so it's not their vineyard.
That's a nice.
I thought it was, but
no.
I mean, it,
well,
looked
no, but it is
terrific.
A vineyard, but it's not his. It's above and below.
Yeah,
and I mean, I think he's got some vines as part of the garden, but it's part of landscaping the hillside.
Coming to an end now. What advice would you give a budding young designer wanting to follow in your footsteps? And now your footsteps have been, you know, not in a straight line, put it that way. Do you have any advice, any pearls of wisdom?
I finally got to do exactly what I wanted to do, you know, after all that time working for my father and being in, you know, places like Nagoya and so on, rather than Tokyo. I mean, I was happy when I got to Tokyo, happy when I got to London. I think just to do what you really enjoy doing, you know, whatever part of architecture it is. I mean, there's room for so many different areas, isn't there? Not just practicing, but writing about it or teaching it or anything. It's just so important, because if you don't enjoy what you're doing, you're not going to be good at it.
I agree. Totally agree with that.
I mean, I remember Crispin that I was working with, who actually taught me at the AA, he said, how on earth do you get all these jobs? Because he was working in with me in the room. And I said, oh, well, I meet people, you know, at parties or socially. I mean, I wasn't being flippant. And I just said, and the next day he came in late, and I said, oh, where are you, you know, what's going on, sort of thing, or, you know, how was last night? And he said, oh, I went to a couple of parties.
So that's a good piece of advice. Go to parties.
well, he didn't come back with any jobs.
No. I want to end with a bit of frivolity, if you can bear with me.
Sure.
You were born under the sign of Taurus, right?
Taurus, yeah.
So I just wanted to see whether you agree with these statements about Taurians. They're not fond of authority.
True.
They can take their pleasure seeking way too far.
Possibly.
Are trustworthy and dependable.
Yes.
Are patient, reliable, and very thorough.
Gosh, that wouldn't be me, if I'm honest.
Very thorough, no?
Oh, yes. I think, yeah. Well, definitely.
That bit, yes.
Definitely thorough, yeah. It's how you interpret it.
Okay.
Definitely. Obsessional.
They appreciate integrity.
Yes.
They are stubborn.
Probably.
Not afraid to stick to their guns.
Definitely.
And lastly, are perfectionists.
Definitely.
Well, then there you go. I think what's clear in talking to you is that, you know, the tenacity of your vision over, well, I think it's almost 40 years now, isn't it? Mid to late 30s. Anyway, you've quietly ploughed through all of those architectural noises that go on around you to create what I think that the architectural theorist Christopher Alexander described as a timeless way of building. So that's what I think about you.
Well, that's very flattering. Yeah, it's a very nice description.
Anyway, John Pawson, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights. It's been a pleasure.
Well, you're very, very welcome, and thank you for listening.